Good morning and welcome to Island Life, Waiheke Radio's weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues. The show is brought to you with the support of the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Oneroa. This morning on Island Life, we look back into our archives. We have an interview with historian Paul Monin on the release of his book, Matiatia, Gateway to Waiheke. We'll take a listen to one of the presentations at the second Y Talks event held at Cable Bay in May this year and take in a live performance from Katie Soljak recorded in 2013. It was exactly a year ago that the Waiheke Library opened, so we'll revisit that. And we introduce a new feature to Waiheke Radio, From the Vaults, taking excerpts from our vast archive of interviews. Currently the focus of an intense legal battle about a proposed marina, Matiatia has an interesting history going back years, decades and even centuries. And that was a topic of a book by historian Paul Monin, Matiatia, Gateway to Waiheke. On the occasion of the book's release in December 2012, Paul spoke on Island Life. Now, whether it's the issues of parking, building of a marina, perhaps disturbing remains on the foreshore, Matiatia always seems to be in the local news. And one of the issues that does concern people about Matiatia and proposed development and changes down there is the impact that has on the heritage and history of the location. And so I thought, well, who better to talk to us about that than Paul Monin, who was just about to release a fantastic new book, A History of Matiatia, Gateway to Waiheke. So, good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Oh, sorry, we'll turn on your right microphone. There you go, that's better.
Good morning, it's great to be here.
Yeah, now this is a lovely looking book that you've just about to release. It's being launched very, very soon, isn't it?
Yes, official release is December the 7th, which is Friday, and the launch is the following day on Saturday, the 8th at Tivoli, 5 p.m.
Now, I mean, Waiheke is a relatively small island. Matiatia, a very particular part of a small island. But you've got enough here to write, you know, a fairly substantial volume on just that place.
Yes. I think I'm correct in saying that very, very few places of this small size have been the subject of a significant book in New Zealand. We are, after all, talking about a valley of only 140 hectares, which is 300 acres, and this is very much a micro study. The justification, though, at the end of the day, is really the geographical attributes of Matiatia Bay. Matiatia Bay is far and away the best natural port on Waiheke Island, and in the last 50 to 60 years it's become our transport hub. So if you want an overall justification, I think it's that. It's a small place with a big function, and with ever more functions being required of it by some interest groups.
And yeah, I mean, as I said in the intro, I mean, there is and seems to have been for the last 5 to 10 years kind of ongoing controversy about, you know, potential developments and changes at Matiatia and the nature of whether it's a hub or whether it's a destination and so on. And increasingly people have turned to history and turned to you as a justification to oppose some of that development or proposals for change, haven't they?
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, do you find that is that people looking for, say, heritage issues to stop development, or has it come from an existing awareness that those heritage issues exist?
Yeah, so I think I think we're going beyond heritage. At Matiatia now, we really are at a major turning point. I think it's the major turning point of the last 100 years. The earlier turning point was the early 20th century when the Allisons took over the farm, when the ownership of the land passed from Māori to Pākehā. 1911 was, coincidentally, 1911 was the year when the first Allison house was barged across the Matiatia. So we're looking at exactly a century. We're at a turning point, and I think whenever you with any place, when at such a moment, this is the time to look back, because we need to understand how we got to where we are before we can decide intelligently how to move forward. So my book, that's the overall purpose of the book. And of course, involved in this explanation of how we've reached where we are, we've got a lot of heritage issues that are of particular interest to me, and a lot of stories, most importantly stories that connect us to Matiti. And I think those stories that are central to our identity, would be a disaster if we took steps now that removed vestiges of those stories, knowledge and memory of those stories.
So often now, I think for many people, Matiatia, you know, it's somewhere where they don't pay a lot of, you know, don't give it a lot of thought. It's, you know, oh, which bus do I get on? Oh, damn, there's a ticket on the car, you know, in the car park. But, I mean, you were referring earlier to the fact that it's become, over the last few decades, increasingly a transport hub. But are you able to paint us maybe a little thumbnail sketch of how the bay and how its function and it's gone over the past.
Yes, I'll do this as quickly as I can. I think most of us are aware that that European economic activity started at the eastern end of the island in the 19th century, based largely on the extraction of kauri timber, of manganese, the wooding and watering of vessels in transit into the 20th century. The focal point shifted westwards. Matiatia from the 1890s became a very popular destination for yachtsmen. There were periodic visits by steamers, and then with the opening of the historic subdivisions, the 1915 to 1924 subdivisions, each of these subdivisions acquired their own wharf. So we had multiple wharves on Waiheke Island. But these were uneconomic, and by the 1950s it was quite clear that they could not be sustained financially. The Waiheke Shipping Company was failing to make a profit. And in about 1960, Matiatia became the sole passenger port on Waiheke Island. So for over 50 years now, Matiatia has had that extremely important function of being the only significant passenger ferry port. There were great hopes that Kennedy Point might come in as a secondary passenger ferry port, but that hasn't come about, and Kennedy Point has been restricted to just freight and vehicles. This is, of course, since it was opened in 1971. But we've had this channeling of services at Matiatia. Of course, a precondition of that was the development of a single arterial road system. Only then, if there was a road link between all of our villages, only then could we talk about a single ferry port. And that single arterial system really began in 1938, and by the 1950s it was in place. My overall thesis, transport thesis in the book, is that Matiatia now has become what geographers call a choke point. It's a place of congestion in a transport system. The Straits of Gibraltar are probably the best global example of a choke point. The English Channel is a choke point, and as a result, but we must face the fact that I think it's going to be very difficult for us to take much of the traffic transport pressure off Matiatia. And for that reason, I feel that we should, as we plan for the future, we should give transport issues primacy. Because at the end of the day, what this is all about Two things, I think. One is the superiority of Maitiatia as a natural harbour, and the other thing are scale economies. You know, that Fuller's, I think, would be very reluctant to open a second very serious passenger ferry service at Kennedy Point, because this would increase their costs considerably. And these were the issues that go back to the 1960s, when the Waiaki Shipping Company was approached about opening serious passenger service at Kennedy Point. So at the end of the day, I think we should be very, very cautious about adding additional functions to Maitiatia like a marina.
Well, I was just to ask you actually about additional functions down the island, but given its suitability as a harbour, and I mean, you know, and in the past, the fact that transport was significantly more difficult or uncomfortable than today, why do you think it is that Maitiatia didn't become, say, the site of a village?
Good question, Chris. Ironically, Fred Allison had in fact intended Maitiatia and Church Bay to be included in the large Maitiatia Onaroa beach estate that he launched in 1924. Maybe I should back up a little bit here. Fred Allison was the owner of the land that was subdivided for the Surfdale beach estate and the Onaroa Maitiatia Beach Estate in 1922, 1923, respectively. I've looked into Fred Allison hoped to include Maitiatia and Church Bay in that subdivision. In fact, you know, something like 300 or 400 sections were planned. For some reason, the Public Works Department declined this part of the subdivision. The Public Works Department approved the Onaroa Blackpool parts. Interestingly enough, Nick Johnson in the 1970s, when he was taking paper off a wall at the Harbour Masters, or somewhere, perhaps it wasn't, but he discovered documents relating to the subdivision of Maitiatia and Church Bay. He deposited these papers with the Waikiki Historical Society, and sadly at the moment we don't quite know where they are, but fortunately Simon Johnson of the Gulf News wrote a very good story on this, and he even included photographs of some of the key documents, and I've used those to fill in a gap that I'd like one day to be able to get to the, you know, get an issue to get to the to explore further and understand further. The building of Maitiatia Wharf in 1923 was actually based on the assumption that there would be a subdivision of Maitiatia. And another wharf was planned for Church Bay. Sorry, Chris, that I'm talking at great length. You could see.
No, I think it's intriguing because, you know, now, you know, I mean, they seem to be in abeyance at the moment, but we've had these proposals to, say, setting up, you know, shopping or cafes and those kind of features at Maitiatia. And, you know, and some of the arguments against it, well, you know, we've heard those arguments ad nauseum, I suppose, but about its function. And, you know, it's interesting to hear that there were actually proposals there and, you know, and perhaps they didn't come to fruition. And, I mean, when... I mean, you may have a sense of this. I mean, we have a very kind of involved community, very opinionated about, you know, development anywhere. I mean, has that always been the case? Has there always been, you know, whenever someone has proposed setting up something or building something somewhere on the island, has there always been that outcry? Or is this something which is a more recent function of our community?
No, that's a good question, Chris. I've actually, in my Waiheke Islander history, published back in 1992, I traced that independent, outspoken tradition here right back to the 1840s. For a number of reasons, Waiheke has attracted quite dynamic, resourceful, self-opinionated, what you will, people in the 1840s. I'm thinking of settlers like Robert McLeod and Isaac Merrick. These were landowners who had to fight for their rights. They disputed with government authorities. They disputed with their neighbours. But I think the community activism here that people like Jacinda Ardern appreciate and Nikki Kaye appreciate. We have a community that's truly democratically active. I trace much of this, though, to the influx of counterculture people in the 1970s. I was one of them, highly educated people who felt strongly about environmental issues and human rights issues and so forth. And we've still got that core on the island, 30, 40 years standing. And of course, I think that to give the newcomers credit, they arrive here and they appreciate the novelty of this place. This place has a distinctive character. It has values that are of significance, obvious to everyone.
And I suppose when you are looking back over the history of a community like Waiheke, that it's that character or that nature of discourse which is the hardest stuff to capture. I mean, you can see plans for subdivision. You can read newspaper articles about proposals to build shops or new wharves or whatever. But that feeling of standing up for the community or speaking out is harder to capture, isn't it?
Yes. And certainly, I think in the 1990s, we started to articulate the Waiheke character. Sandra Lee talked about the Waiheke way. The 2000 document is titled Essentially Waiheke. We do have a real sense of identity here, which I think we've now articulated fairly distinctly. I think, for example, you've referred to the Waiheke Infrastructure Limited proposals for a big development. Those proposals were on the table from 2000 to 2005 until Auckland City purchased Maitea Flat. And the objections basically to the proposals by the people and in the end also by the Environment Court was that the scale of development proposed was too large and urban for Waiheke. It was out of character for this place. We want small-scale development. We want residential rural, if we're going to go into our green belt, it has to be development that integrates buildings with the retention of substantial green areas. And I remember when I in the 1980s, it was often said that too many Waiheke people were overeducated and underemployed, and that perhaps rather facetiously, that's an element too that we've got. Every census so it makes it quite clear we've got the most highly educated population in New Zealand.
And I mean, what are the things? I mean, at the moment, we've seen, say, with Whareitana Bay. I mean, with Maitea, and then more recently with Whareitana Bay, that people are concerned about the heritage of the island being lost. What are the areas? I mean, because if anyone understands that heritage on the island, it's probably you more than anyone that you feel are most at risk. What are the things that you think we risk losing?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'd like to go back to where I started, really. We are at a turning point, not just at Maitea, I think throughout the island. In other words, we're putting into place now protections that will, I think, determine, that will stand for the next 50 years. We haven't quite finalised the district plan. The district plan has a big heritage component. What's finalised will stand for 50 years, and so it's a critical moment. It's a critical moment for heritage. Let's start there. Getting on to your question, what are the values, and which are the values that I'm particularly concerned about? I'm particularly concerned about coastal values. We've got key coastal stretches that are under threat or potentially under threat, and I would include Motiatia there. I think Motiatia actually building a facility out into the bay will be a new one for us here. We haven't had that yet, and it'll be very difficult to reverse. Any construction down there will be very difficult to reverse, particularly land reclamation for a small car park. We've got encroachment on Esplanade strips or coastal yards, as at Faretana. I fought quite resolutely on the Cactus Bay to Ōwhiti stretch. The development of that coast is only a matter of time, and I'm talking about the coast, potentially the coast from Cactus Bay right around Hook's Point and back to Manawa Bay. We are going to have to... That's due for some sort of subdivision, big block subdivision in the future, and we will have to ready ourselves for what that will bring in terms of potential modification to that really precious coastal strip.
I suppose looking at the aspects of history that you write about, you tend to, correct me if I'm wrong here, but you focus, I suppose your starting point is geographical, perhaps. You've talked about the character of people on the island, but you're not a writer who focuses on, say, those kind of social interaction, the people so much. It's more about the history of the place. Would that be a fair summary of your approach?
Yes. My university education also involved geography, so I'm actually very interested in how we use resources. I think my Motiatia book is in significant parts. It's almost an historical geographical history or historical geography.
Although of course it does touch on the people, like, you know, Don Chappell, for example.
Oh yes. And also I am very interested in the Pākehā Māori interface. I in fact cut my teeth on treaty history in the 1990s when my early Waiheke book is also, it only takes the story up to 1920, and that really is dominated by race relations and land transactions. So again, that's my experience. I am interested in human interest stories, and in some respects, some of my appeal to audiences is from this quarter. I've had a number of people say, "Oh, Paul, you know, you are good at putting people into your stories," and in some respects, that's all very relative, because most historians, treaty historians, and you know, are a bit weak on that. Yes.
Now, I mean, you mentioned before that you wrote a book, A History of the Island, in 1992, and I thought, in fact, just before I came to the island in 96, 97, and when I knew I was shifting here, one of the things I did from Dunedin, I got that book at the library, and I read that book with a map, you know, in one hand and the book in the other, so I kind of knew where I was shifting to. But, and, you know, that's 20 years ago now. But you're still finding new angles, new aspects of those stories to tell. I mean, people sometimes think of the history as static. It's something that's happened. You know, how can you keep on retelling the stories?
Yes, well, history is a work in progress. At no point can we say that this is the definitive history. That's the case for a number of reasons. One, of course, is the fact that new sources are coming to light all the time. I think that... I don't know whether you go online much. I'm not terribly keen, but papers past historical New Zealand newspapers online is an amazing source. You can just go in there, New Zealand newspapers, a large number of them from the 1840s through to the 1930s are online there. Put in your search word, and I've trawling papers past, I've come across some really interesting human interest stories from Waikiki Island in the 19th century that I would love to have used in earlier writing. I suppose the second, I've talked about new sources coming up, but secondly, I think we also put different questions to the past, depending on current interests. The very famous, I was just thinking about it, the very famous Italian historian Benedetto Croce said that all history is contemporary history. In other words, in that sense, he's meaning that when we look at the past, we're always applying contemporary present-day concerns, questions to it. We're expecting the past to be relevant to our present. And as a result, all history is contestable. I think that history is extremely challenging as an intellectual endeavour and as an area of writing. It's extremely challenging for all of these reasons.
So, I mean, obviously there's a bit of a lag between completing the book and then, you know, getting it to this point where it's a lovely looking book here I've got in front of me. So no doubt in the meantime you've started to kind of consider what your next topic might be and where your next bit of writing might be?
Well, I've...
Or have you taken a breather?
Yeah, for 10, 12 years I've been working on a book on the Māori trading fleet of the period 1840 to 1870. This was the time when Māori purchased cutters and schooners to transfer their produce to settler markets. It's a fascinating subject. I've made a bit of a cross for myself because the sources are not that abundant. And also, I'm not a boatie, so I feel that I'm going to have to get a lot of advice from boatie friends to make sure that I don't make any stupid comments about the rigging of these small vessels. So this is my current project. I would also like to write more about Waiheke Island. A lot of people have been pressuring me to republish the 1992 book, but I think what's called for now is a general history, right up to the present, focusing on, you know, the main themes, the main issues, with a lot of human interest content, something that something that'll have a broad appeal, something that won't. I have to admit that at times, you know, I do deserve the charge of being a rather academic historian. I do research vigorously, and the skill with research is to try to push it to the background. I think the most severe indictment of a comment on a history writer's work is, oh, your work is well researched. To me, it means it's dense and it's dull, you know, it's heavy going. So I would, if I have time, I would love to write a general Waiheke history. That benefits from the 30 years of work I've done in the field.
And I imagine, you know, certainly there's an audience for it because, I mean, as you said before, people feel a connection, don't they? I mean, in a different way than someone living in Auckland might read a history of Auckland, someone living on Waiheke is going to feel much more connected to a history of Waiheke.
Yes.
So
yes.
This book, Paul, where is it available?
Yes, that's going to be on sale in the two honor roll bookshops, Take Note and Tivoli. I'm launching at Tivoli, as I said before, I'm launching on Saturday, the 8th of December at 5 p.m. in the forecourt in front of Tivoli. There will be some wine and nibbles. Everyone's welcomed. I'll be there to sign and chat with people. So I'd love to see a great turnout.
Yeah, great.
Mike Lee is the guest speaker, and Bruce Kroll is the special guest. Bruce Kroll has been a wonderful source of oral information for me, and as I mentioned, I think I did, that 1911 Allison House was the Kroll house that was barged across. His Don's grandfather and father were present on that occasion. So we've got in Bruce Kroll, we've got a fantastic personal connection with the bay.
Fantastic. And just putting you on the spot, we'd love to have you back at some point just to kind of maybe pick out particular parts of the island and tell some of the stories in more detail. It's been fascinating having you here this morning.
No, that'll be a pleasure, Chris.
Great. Yes. Well, thanks very much. This is Paul Monin, author of Matiatia, Gateway to Waiheke, which, as he says, is being launched on December the 8th and highly recommended by us here at Waiheke Radio. Thanks very much, Paul.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Why Talks is an initiative to put on a series of events featuring inspirational speakers talking on a variety of themes. On the 30th of May, Why Talks held their second event at Cable Bay Vineyard, focusing on the topic of light. One of the speakers was Toi Te Rangi Uai, or Paura.
Nā te ko whao ki te kore, nā te kore ki te pō, nā te pō ki te rapunga. Nā te rapunga ki te whaia, nā te whaia ki te kukini, nā te kukini ki te hihiri, nā te hihiri ki te mahara. Nā te mahara ki te hiningaro, nā te hiningaro ki te mānako. Nā te mānako ki te wānanga, nā te wānanga ki te āhua, nā te āhua ki te atamai, nā te atamai ki te whiwhia. Nā te whiwhia ki te rawea, nā te rawea ki te hau ora, nā te hau ora ki te hōpūtū. Nā te hōpūtū ka moe arangi nui ki a papatūnu ki te wātia. Nā te wehenga ki te whaiau ki te ao marama ti hei wā mauri ora. The Māori world of light and life relays a cosmogony that begins with the void, the abyss, and moves through a progression of energy seeking form and this world of light. The projection above is an ultrasound scan of my wife Linda and my firstborn son, Tawara. He was born on a Friday morning at the time of Matariki. Tawara is the name given to Venus as a morning star, it's masculine. The Latin equivalent would be Lucifer, the shining one, the morning star. As son number one, he is a shining light for both of us, and at times a devil for his younger brother. For myself, dispersion harkens back to my time as an apprentice jeweler in Parnell, where through a study of gemology, we learnt of the seven crystal systems and the categorization of the four C's of gemstones. The carat, or weight, clarity, color, and cut are exemplified in the brilliant cut of a diamond, where white light entering the stone is refracted by the many facets and dispersed in a radiance of fire. I believe that for all of us, diamonds in the rough, life's experiences add weight and colour to a clear, pure body of light. Our investigation into the relationships within these experiences reflects the dispersion of that radiant fire. For myself, my own journey begins and maybe ends with my mother, Sarah Janet Rangiwaia Deary. Around the age of seven, a school project to draw the early Roman emperors had me beat. Several attempts through the evening left me frustrated and with no joy. My mother sent me off to bed with a promise to finish the drawings that night. When I awoke in the morning, I found a perfect rendering of Romulus and Remus being suckled beneath the wolf mother. It was from that moment that a light ignited within myself, and I decided to dedicate myself to perfecting the ability to draw. Skip ahead 7 years. At 14, I was further influenced
by the sci-fi writer Isaac Asimov's story of an artist who had honed his sculptural skills to create a talismanic works for clients, to release them from their sufferings and to reconnect them to their core being. A second book based on the life of a Tibetan monk set me off exploring various forms of nightly meditations, astral projections, mantra, and visualizing etheric and astral forms. 2 years after that, 3 days before my 16th birthday, tragedy struck our family. My mother had a brain hemorrhage. Her condition was heralded the night before by a shrieking cry that encircled the house and woke us all. During her comatose state in hospital, there was a lot of play of light manifestations of both white and black witnessed by myself and others singly and collectively. It was through one of these moments, through a manifestation on a journey we had been sent to Hamilton. My uncle was a priest of Church College, and my cousins and I went walking up to the upper temple, and I sat looking down at the statue of Jesus with his hands out like that, and I asked for my mother's life to be spared. At that time, through meditation and looking down, my cousin sitting behind me, the lights went out. I felt this presence behind me, large, over my right side, and I offered up myself in an obligation in order to secure my mother's life. Once that had done, the lights came on. I turned around, my cousin was gone, I went searching for her. I asked her, not wanting to project onto her, what she saw. She saw a large figure standing behind me. So, this has been a big part of my life. My mother lives today, although trapped within a damaged mind. Several years later, when both of my grandparents died, I'm now named after my grandfather, Polder, my mother's parents. Down in Blenheim, I made a pilgrimage back to the East Coast on their behalf. In the Māori, this is known as a koe mate. You make that pilgrimage on behalf of those that haven't made it back. And there I was reacquainted with my papakāinga, the land where I was born, the land where my grandparents were born, the land where my tipuna signed the Treaty of Waitangi. And there I met an auntie who informed me about a great-great-great-grandfather, Riwai Pakiro, one of the five main tohunga whakairo for carving and painting tribal histories in the whare nui of the east coast of the 19th century. I made a promise to the Kaumātua in 1984 that I would continue his work, his lexicon. The largest to date rests in France, in Leila Pidiales, of which this year Matariki is the dedication and naming ceremony. I have, over the past four decades, from 14, indulged in the exploration of light through many teachers, texts, and self-inquiry through the many practices of meditation, dramatic rituals of invocation and evocation of elements and planets, angels and gods of many cultures. I've studied Kabbalah, the Gita, not the guitar, Christianity, Sufism, Zen, Buddhists, and Māori texts, astrology, numerology, tarot, runes, and the I Ching. I've had white robes, black robes, and robes of many colors, all in the pursuit and building the body of light. The Sufi mystic Rumi tells a story of Moses wandering through the desert and coming upon a shaman building stone altars and speaking in tongues. Moses stops to correct him and the praxis of communing with God and walks away, chuffed with his work. As Moses departs, the voice of God catches him and chastises him for breaking the shaman's personalized communion. In Māori, we have a term, ukaipō. U is the word for breast, kai for food, and pō, the night. Ukaipō is a reference for the infant, suckled in the night. It's that place of nurture that light finds home. In Nietzsche's Thus Spoke Zarathustra, a man enters into the sanctuary of the cave's darkness in order to clarify the world of light and reveal the overman to the external world. And Ngāti Rā, beneath a cafe called Sola, you'll find another such cave. If you chance to enter My Man Cave, amongst the jewels and sculptures are altars adorned with icons, photos of teachers, fathers, mothers, and sons, and 14 years of ash-mounded incense prayers. There are 58 facets on a brilliant cut diamond. Should you enter my gallery, my cave, you may well discover other facets to this diamond in the rough. Nō reira, ia kautama kia putana o koutou maramatanga, he whakawhitiwhiti i te ao. Ki ngā tipuna, kuhi ki te pō. Kia whakawhiturangitia rātou i te korowai ārangi. Nō reira, to those who have gone on, who are now stars in the night sky on the cloak of Rangi Nui, we offer our thanks to all of us who are here, to those to come. Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Ka huri.
That was Waiheke artist Polder speaking at the Wai Talks event at Cable Bay Vineyard on May the 30th of this year.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM.
In October 2013, Waiheke songwriter and musician Katie Soljak released a new album, but one with a difference. It had actually been recorded many, many years earlier. She joined Waiheke Radio on the occasion of our fifth birthday on October the 26th, 2013, to talk about the release of the album and to perform some songs from it.
And now we've got something very special. We're joined by Katie Soljak. She's here in the studio with us. How are you, Katie?
Great, thank you.
And this this weekend is also the launch of your new album.
That is right. It went live on Friday onto iTunes. Yeah. And we're releasing it at the King's Arms on Sunday.
But this is a new album, but an old album, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it's 20 years old and in recording, but I haven't released it till now.
So why have you sat on it for so long?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that. It's so funny because hardly anybody's asked me why. But, I was just a bit at odds with the title track. It had because it had a few swear words in it, but it was as part of the poetry. And I was teaching school in Los Angeles at the time, and I just couldn't put it out. And then it took me 20 years for a Raglan DJ, Johnny Cole, said, well, if you just drop that one verse out, it's totally radio-friendly, the whole, you know, and I basically shelved it. And he was right. And so I thought, well, actually, I could release it now. So I didn't think of that so long ago. I don't know.
Excellent. So it must be nice to see finally have it out in the light of day.
It is. It's very exciting when it goes onto iTunes because it's live around the world.
But has it been odd? You know, I mean, your music career has continued and developed over those 20 years.
Oh yes, yes.
And what you're playing now, and you know, the way you go about your craft now, I presume is very different from what it was 20 years ago.
Yes, in some ways. But I'm still writing and things, but the style's probably changed a bit. This is different from my regular blues album, yeah.
Yeah, so it wasn't an uncomfortable feeling. Sometimes, you know, it's like you're looking at the teenage diary and you go, oh, dear.
No, I'm quite proud of the work. I can. That's why I didn't only drop that one verse out. The rest is exactly how we recorded it. I mean, it's the original recording and artwork from 1993.
Wow, good stuff. And you're going to play us a couple of tunes from
it
today.
Yes, we are, actually. I've got my lovely singing partner, Katarina. here. She's come all the way over from overseas in Auckland and missed the 10 o'clock version. So much congestion down there at the moment, apparently. She sang with me about 10 years ago a lot, and now she's part of this new project that to do the band that's doing the songs from the album.
Yeah.
And so this is the first, yeah.
So we'll get you to come around here.
She's going
to
come. She's got a ukulele and a lovely singing voice. And we're going to do the first song off the album, which is called Safe Zone. Follow the angel, beckoning high above the howl of the night crawlers and the stink of the alley, and take my arm, dear one. Look, we have found her. Maria Estrada de Marie, and look, Jesus and Moses are talking, and statue of Maria is weeping, praying for peace, weeping for the world. White flowers adorn her. Here, sit on the stone bench and let the secrets of the silence whisper in your maiden soft hair, my dear one. Everything has changed. Stood open to all who came, soul broken and grieving hearts, all who came. Say, oh, the streets are a sly and a hungry tiger. Watch it doesn't grab you and take you down. Sit with me here, child, and close your eyes. This is the safe zone.
Fantastic stuff. There's live music here in our studio in 4 Karora Road. Brilliant. There's Katie Soljak. And the opening number, is it, Katie, from the new album?
It's the first track. It's called Safe Zone, yeah.
Yeah, brilliant. That's good. And we should say as well that the album is now out and available for sale. So, you know, if you're get along here now. Katie's here and she can sell you a copy.
I'll sign one for you, actually.
Yeah, signed copies. And
also they're at Ireland's gift store.
Excellent.
And iTunes.
Excellent.
Worldwide.
Yep, so it's gone digital. It's good stuff. And I believe you're going to play us another song.
Yes, and if they come to the Stefano's gig or the King's Arms gig, it's $20 and it includes a CD.
Oh, that's a great deal.
It's ridiculous, isn't it?
God, what was I thinking? Yes.
I was in a generous mood. Now, this one is actually Brendan's favourite. Hello, Brendan. Hello. I'm going to do Old Wooden Radio live. About five, I think. Hundreds. Why? Grab your guitar. This is a song I wrote to my dad on Father's Day 20 years ago. An odd shaped jar. And that old wooden radio, who was your favorite singer? I tried to sing like her. Who was she? She had a catch in her voice, and I could do that. I could do that. I was that singer for you, Father. Rise to Waimarama on Sundays in the roar of the ocean. We like that about you. Watched as you ride the surf, see it made far out to the line where the sky meets the sea, and you weren't dad anymore, you were a daughter. I'm alive. You weren't dad anymore. You weren't dad anymore. You were Tarzan. A fifth day you put away now. Is it good scotch? Is it good scotch? I hope it's good scotch, Dad. Good scotch, you're wasting all our money on. All our money on. I hope it's good scotch, Dad. And you were too out of it the other day to talk to, but I wanted to tell you I can sing good now. Wanted to tell you I remember all the good times. Fresh cut grass or Old Spice cologne, I think about you. I think about you. I think about you. And I wonder how much longer you'll be around.
Oh, I have to say, Katie, I've always loved that song. Oh, so it's a real pleasure to have you play it here live with us in the studio. Fantastic stuff.
Thanks for asking us.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate you coming in and playing, and you too, Katarina. Fantastic. So, so do pop along and grab a CD or get along to Stefano's. I think that's going to be a really nice place to see those songs.
Yes, and they have a bit of a stage there. And come to the King's Arms gig, everybody, because you get five bands, and there's the Road Warriors as well, Swampland, and Bernie Griffin and the Flaming Pearls, these Americana bands, and Silke Hartung, who does Freak the Sheep, she's doing the opening spot. So that'll be a lot of fun tomorrow also.
Excellent, yeah.
And you don't have to worry about because Monday's a holiday.
Yeah, good stuff.
No, so thanks a lot.
A great gig. Thank you very much. All right, so I think it's just about time to round up the show. You've been listening to Island Life here on Waiheke Radio. A little bit over time, but that's all right. We're just that's the way we're doing things today.
Waiheke Radio.
It was 1 year ago tomorrow that the fantastic new Waiheke Library was opened. We did a live broadcast from the opening ceremony, capturing the opening itself and interviews with the Mayor, Paul Walden, and many other key players. You can hear all of that on our website www.waihekiradio.org.nz. What follows are a couple of highlights, the unveiling of the opening plaque and an interview with the head librarian, Fiona Krolicek. On Saturday the 26th of July 2014, Waiheke Pataka Korero, the magnificent new Waiheke Library, was officially opened. Waiheke Radio broadcast the event live, and what follows are some of the highlights from the opening ceremony and also some interviews we conducted on the day. So what we've got happening at the moment is a group of children being greeted by the mayor. They're walking over to the plaque, which is about to be unveiled. It's covered with a blue satin cloth at the moment on a small tripod. Mayor Liam Brown standing to the right. Komatua standing to the left. And a small group of children who I think are going to have the opportunity and the privilege of unveiling the plaque for the new Waiheke Library. The photographers are gathering. And any moment now, here we go, everyone's getting their cameras in position. And there we go.
July 2014.
So that was one of the children there children reading the plaque.
During the creation
then we got
the
little Vermeulen Brown.
And that is the reason why they have come up here in particular today. Ryan, beautifully done. Very, very difficult, young boy. When everyone's listening and you did just absolutely superb, let's give our hands together again for Ryan.
We are at the opening of Waiheke Pātaka Kōrero, the new Waiheke Library, and the woman of the moment is with me now, the head librarian here at Waiheke Library, Fiona Krolicek. Congratulations, Fiona. This must be a really special day for you.
It's up there with the birth of my son, if I'm honest. It's one of the best days of my life. We've just got what we need for our community. Everybody has worked so hard. This is completely a team effort. You've got an idea of the history that's gone into this, the ups and downs and the wins and the way, and we've got here. All of us have created this.
Yeah, it's an amazing space. So tell us a little about what's different between the old library and this new library.
Well, the obvious, the size. And it's new and it's lovely to have. We've got completely new stock almost. We've had almost well over $100,000 worth of stock put into this library. Wonderful new purpose designed furniture, places for people to hang out. It's okay to bring your coffee in if you want to. We're not going to start up a coffee machine. We're not in competition, but we want to encourage people to feel at home, because the key thing is that it belongs to us all and it's a place where everyone is welcome.
So as well as that, I suppose the openness of the building, the enlarged collection,
yep.
there's new kind of additions to the collection, isn't there, and new facilities, new things, yep. People will be able to do new things here.
We've got significantly more computers for people to use. We've got 10 public computers now. We've got improved Wi-Fi. We've got a space that we're calling the quiet room currently that people will be able to use for various things, meetings and whatnot, if they want to. For example, we've got the special votes happening in there prior to the elections, so that kind of thing. And really, we're learning the building as much as the public will be, because we want to know how you want to use it. So come and talk to us about what you want to do in it. It's a resource that's so valuable, and the landscaping around it, they just feed into each other. We'll be able to do some wonderful things here.
And you've got enlarged staffing contingent as well.
I think I never remember, because there's so many more. I've got about 5 more staff, 4 of which are from the island. That's due to us having increased opening hours. We're open Saturday and Sunday now, and slightly longer during the week, through to 6 o'clock now. So need more staff. The idea is that staff out there in the library helping customers at the shelves.
Great. Well, I know you've had a very busy day and an early start to the day as well.
4 o'clock I got up.
4 o'clock. And I imagine there's been a lot of kind of stress and anxiety leading up to this opening day as well.
There's been quite a bit of stress and a little anxiety, but we've got through it all and we've resolved everything, and look at the result.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Well, congratulations. It's really a marvellous place. So,
Thank you very much.
We look forward to enjoying it in the decades to come.
Absolutely. I look forward to everybody coming to see us.
Fantastic. Thank you. Krolicek, the librarian here at Waiheke Library. All right, I think that we're about to wrap up our special broadcast here from the opening of the library. We've been broadcasting live from the courtyard, the newly opened courtyard at the rear of the Waiheke Library. It's been a great day with the official opening ceremony, and then just really since then, people just enjoying the space, enjoying the library. The council have done a pretty grand job, really. The Waiheke Rotary have come on board with the sausage sizzle, and there's a really nice feel here as people are just enjoying the space and enjoying the occasion. It's been a pleasure to bring this to you from Waiheke Radio. Welcome to From the Vaults, an occasional series delving into Waiheke Radio's archives of interviews. In July 2012, Island Life host Sharon Brown spoke to the then local board deputy chair, Joe Holmes, now a voracious blogger and social media pundit.
And what have been some of the sort of the things you're a bit like, oh God, is there anything like that? I know.
I said in the paper recently, the thing that possibly surprised me, although it shouldn't be a surprise, but it really did surprise me, I guess, was that was that people felt that they could be abusive.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, everybody who puts their hand up to do that kind of work does it out of a sense of community. And whatever else, even if people don't agree with what you do, it shouldn't leave room for people to feel that they can be abusive to you.
Mm.
And I found that a challenge, I have.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't know if it's... Yeah, I don't know what that is. People do generally seem to feel that it's okay. And I notice that on especially things like Facebook sites as well, that there seems to be a real sort of, you know, big free-for-all of saying things that are really inappropriate.
I couldn't agree more. And I don't go onto those Facebook sites.
No, I'm actually quite keen to come off them.
Yeah, I honestly, this is a real serious comment I'm about to make. I think they're seriously bad for your health.
Yeah, well, I was wondering... What about that, actually?
And funnily enough, there are people. There was an article, I think it was in last week's Herald, saying exactly that. That there's now clinical studies being done on the effects of Facebook and on the and websites and use of the internet and people on there 38 hours a week. And you can sort of see that, I think, on those some of those community sites where people are, you know, they're just rattling things backwards and forwards all the time. So I'm told, because I have to be told this, because I don't want to go and have a look at it, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And I think it's sort of compounded by the fact that a lot of the people who are posting up on Facebook, which is a particular kind of relationship with other people, are also seeing each other within the community. So in some ways, potentially, it's more hurtful.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's not just an anonymous blob on the other side of the world. It's actually someone in your community, and then you're making quite personal comments about them.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of the Wild West. Seriously. You know, anything goes. It's a free-for-all. And there are some good aspects to that, but there is also an aspect which is very, very dangerous, and particularly for young people, I think.
Yeah.
You know, cyberbullying amongst youth is a real problem, a real, real problem, and it leads to suicide. So, you know, it's not something that we can take lightly.
No, that's true.
From the Vaults, highlights and excerpts from Waiheke Radio's interview archive. You can find the full interviews on www.waihekiradio.org.nz. You've been listening to the interviews from Island Life, a weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7pm and Thursdays at 12:30pm. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onioroa.